Here's the deal. We've been in this series called Find Your Focus, and we're really trying to find our focus both individually and as a church as a whole. And there are several things we've been talking about. Next week, we'll start talking about equipping, which is all about maturing people, and Al Frank will be here to speak about spiritual battle, because it's one of those key things in our spiritual maturity. After that, in the following month, we're going to talk about praying, which is all about dependence on God. And then the month after that, we're going to talk about reach, which is all about compassion, about a love for people, a compassion for them. But in this last month, we've been talking about belong, which is all about connection. And in this whole thing, the last several weeks, we've been talking about these questions. First of all, what prevents us from experiencing belongingness? And it's really that fundamental thing out of Genesis 3, when the sin, we began to hide from each other and hurl blame at each other, and we messed up all the relationships in Genesis 3. The second thing is, how can we experience belongingness? How can we experience connectedness? The fact that we all belong to what the scriptures say, we belong to the day, to the light of God, and we belong to each other. The third question we asked last week was, what qualities produce belongingness? We talked about the fact that we need to be humble and patient and kind and bear with one another, and that we would protect the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace in the church. And so that would produce belongingness. This week, what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about another question. It's, what is deconstructing belongingness today? What is deconstructing this? Now, there's a book I recently was given to me by one of you, and I've read it, and it's, I tell you the truth, I really, really liked it. I really resonated with it. It's called The Great Evangelical Recession by John Dickinson. It's he's a free pastor in the Prescott, Arizona, but the book is excellent. And the subtitle is Six Factors That Will Crash the American Church and How to Prepare for It. I thought it was really interesting, and I just want to kind of throw it out there because I think these are real, because we can tell, we sense that there is a change happening in our culture. We sense it, we know it, we kind of sometimes want to hide from it and push it away, but the reality is that the church's situation in America is changing. It used to be that pastors were one of the top two or three most trusted people in a community. If you look at surveys to now, they're at the bottom of the list. And the church itself has kind of moved down the list, too, of trusted organizations. And there are things happening in our culture that I think we need to know. And so the six things he says is that the church is inflated, it's hated, it's divided, it's corrupt, it's bleeding, and it's sputtering. Let's just look at those real quickly. What he says is this, under inflated, is that we are actually probably much smaller as a group, evangelicals. Now, the evangelicals aren't the only group of Christians in the United States, but there's this group that really cares about wanting to move the gospel forward in an evangelical sense, and that we're probably much smaller than surveys have shown, that we're probably only 7% of the population in actuality, whereas most part we've been saying we were probably 30, 40% of the population. He suggests that it's not true, and I think he's right. Second thing is that we are hated, sometimes by our explicit theology, that people hate biblical stances on certain issues, and as a result, the church seems to be, or is accused of being, a hate-monger group of people, and as a result, we are hated too. But sometimes we're even hated for not just our explicit theology, but by our implicit theology, the way we do it. And sometimes we've not done it well. We have been very judgmental and sometimes so separatist and so sometimes so inappropriate that there is almost an appropriate hateness that comes with it. And sometimes we're hated increasingly. And you can see across the world that evangelicals are increasingly attacked, put down, isolated by what we believe and sometimes the way we go about it. Also, we're incredibly divided. The church is becoming increasingly divided on cultural and even political issues. And that has really drawn people apart. It's almost like, hey, you can't dare show up to that particular church if you're a Republican. Or you can't show up to that particular church if you're a Democrat. And some of the things. And we've become very divided as a church in the United States. And I think he's right. And it's even increased by that individualism that happens in our own lives. I'm going to seek my own personal peace and affluence. Yeah, I hope it goes well for you. And it's really divided the church. So third, bankrupt, or fourth, bankrupt. He estimates in the next 25 years that giving in churches will drop by 70%. We've already seen this begin to happen. You know, the famous Crystal Cathedral in Southern California, they went bankrupt and sold it to the Catholic Church. And you see churches giving go down. And we live with a generation that has the money right now, an older generation that has the money, and they have a propensity to give. But the younger generation doesn't have it and has a propensity not to give. And the guesstimation that most churches will go down by 70% in the next 25 years. And so we have to understand that and prepare for that. So fifth, bleeding. Estimated impact that 65% of millennials are basically those in their 20s and 30s, that 65% of the millennials will leave the church by the year 2030. They'll just find it irrelevant or difficult to be a part of or just not interested, and they'll move away. 65%. That's amazing, isn't it? And sputtering, that while the U.S. population is soaring, the number of new believers is drastically slowed down. Profoundly. We're sputtering. There's not much extra fuel coming into the engine, if you will. Those are not, you know, really great thoughts. Those are reality, and I think they're pretty accurate. I don't know if they're exactly precisely accurate, but I think they're pretty accurate. Doesn't paint a pretty picture, does it? Can you think about, okay, here we are planting a church three years into it, thinking about a building here, there, or wherever. You're like, oh, maybe we ought to just give up on this thing. And you think, no, I bet that's not true. They're probably the things that we need to do to prepare, though, are these things. How to prepare for that? There are six things. Is revaluing, goodness, uniting, being solvent, healing, and reigniting. Let me just go through those real quickly. I think he's right. Revaluing, a call to recognize our dependence on God. The church so often has been able to kind of do its own thing and do it out of the flesh, but to revalue our dependence on God and who he is, what he's all about, to really commit ourselves to that, to revalue what he wants to do and who he is in our world. Second is a goodness, a call to rediscover seeking the welfare of other people. That somehow a church that would seek the goodness of people and the good for people will not be irrelevant in a day and age of tremendous need. That there might be the identified churches, Christians, is saying, well, I don't know about this or that, but I can tell you is they're good. They're good. They have a goodness in their heart rather than evil or a hatred in their heart. That they have a goodness in their heart. Third, uniting. I think this is true. A call to reuniting the evangelical commitment. That we would really unite and stop competing with one another. There's a place for all these churches, right? There is a place for everyone. They all have a different flavor. We have a flavor. I don't know what it is, but we have a flavor. I like to think of it as salsa, you know? And I think you guys are a pretty spicy salsa. You know, I like it. But whatever it is that we all, but we're not competing with the church down the street. You know, we're in this thing together, and there's a place for all of these churches because really giant churches eventually become very impersonal. And there's a place to be able to remain personal. But we're not competing with Ellisville Baptist. We're not competing with the Presbyterian Church down the street. We're not competing with the Lutherans down the street. We're all on the same side of this thing, right? We're going to pull together. And we want to allow ourselves to be a compliment to them, an encouragement to them, and hopefully even a catalyst to them. And frankly, we want them to be that for us, an encouragement to us, a compliment to us, and a catalyst to us, because we're all in this thing together. And I think we're going to have to do that because we look silly to the non-Christian world when there's this competition. We look crazy, and I think maybe sometimes we are. But fourth, we need to be solvent. It's a call to redefine ministry and its funding. If it's really actually going to go down, then we're going to have to be committed to a low overhead, which is exactly what the elders have said in recent months, is that we want to live within a low overhead. So we're not going to hire a large staff to do all the ministry. It's going to be all of us who do the ministry. We're not going to build giant buildings that cost us, you know, that we go into huge debt. We're going to try to keep that low so that we have as much possible to give, to invest outside of ourselves. Fifth, there needs to be some healing, I think. I think a call to rebirth of discipleship and of shepherding people. to care for people, to call people to a walk with Christ, to commit their whole lives, to say, okay, I'm going to live a holy life. Not a perfect life, but I want to walk with him. I'm going to say no to the things of the past, and I'm going to say yes to the things of the future. I think we're going to have to call people so that we're distinctive in our culture. And last, a reigniting, a call to the resurrect personal evangelism. Meaning not that you have to go out and stand on a street corner, but that those people in our lives who are ready to give an answer for the hope that lives inside of us, to bring that, to kind of reignite that in our world today. I think he's right. I think these are really good. So I want to go back just for a second to this healing, to the rebirth of discipleship and shepherding. And I just want to touch real quickly on one little piece of it that is so against our culture. Okay, I've said little about it before. I want to say a little bit more today. I want to encourage it. I don't want to suggest that this is going to like change the whole direction of all of us in every way. I don't think that. It may not do anything, but I do think it's worth mentioning. I think it's important, though we could ignore it. And here's what it is. This is our distinctive. In Quest, we say this is our distinctive. We probably haven't been the greatest at it. We probably haven't talked about it as much as we should have, but this is one of our distinctives, is to be a dynamic and integrated partnership of generations. A dynamic and integrated partnership of generations. Now, I want to be really careful here how I say this, because sometimes I haven't been clear, so I want to make sure I'm clear. With a special focus on the 20 to 40-year-old men and women, the kids in their lives, the friends in their lives, and the neighbors in their lives, and I mean this real wholeheartedly, and the people who are older than them who have a heart. Let's put a heart on that, because hearts are as good as circles. Good. Okay. To have a heart to invest in the 20 to 40-year-old man and woman, and the kids in their lives, and the friends in their lives, and the neighbors in their lives. You see, we need one another. I want to go back to this chart. I've done this for you before, but I think it's really important. Or no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to go to a chart. I'm going to go to Titus. Look at this, you guys. This is really powerful in Titus. He says, but as for you, teach what accords with sound doctrine. So here's Paul speaking to Titus, and he's saying, now make sure that you speak according to sound doctrine. And then immediately after that, he jumps right into this discussion about relationships. And you think, well, that's interesting. The sound doctrine is this. He says that in order to pull that off, older men, let's highlight older men. Older men are to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. An older generation that models these incredible qualities of stability and usefulness and vitality, that they would live this out. Older men. Now, older men, who are they? Well, I don't know. It's always someone older than me, right? That's what older men are. And I would probably suggest in scriptural terms that really meant people about 40 or above were all older men. And I think, man, I've been old for a long time, and I didn't even know it. But older men, this generation that's been through enough that would say, hey, I want you to live out being sober-minded, clear-minded in what you do, dignified in how you live, self-controlled, sound in your faith, sound in your love, sound in your steadfastness to life. Wow, that's a great generation. And if they live that way, we need them. You can't get away without me. Well, you probably could, but you need that. And then it says, let's go to here, older women. Likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, and not slanderers or slaves to much wine, which can happen in life, right? When life gets really hard, it's easy to start to self-medicate and try to wash it away in some way or to turn really bitter towards others. It says, women, don't do that. They are to teach what is good. And so train the younger women. Let's circle younger women. It's to train younger women. It's to be connected to these younger gals, to love their husbands and children, to really love them. In a day and age where it's easy to forget them, but to really actually love them deeply. To be self-controlled, pure, working at home. It doesn't mean that you can't have a job outside the home, but that the home doesn't become forgotten in the process. Because, gals, there is something that a guy doesn't bring to the table that you do bring to the table about making this thing called not just a house, but a home. Some of us just don't have the knack. Both guys, you gals, you bring something to the table that we are in poverty without. And he's saying that here. You know, to be working at home, there's a kindness and a submission to their own husbands. Doesn't mean subservient. It means in proper relationship to your husband. And we see that that's so sometimes hard to maintain. And that the word of God may not be reviled. Wow, that's incredible. Look at this. Then, likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. It doesn't say a ton about younger men. Be self-controlled. To be men of great focus rather than no focus at all. Men that put down the controller to the Xbox. You guys, it's stunning to me how many times I speak to guys who are absolutely removed by other things. But young men who step up and step in to life, to lead and to care, to love and to sacrifice. Wow. And then he speaks here to Titus. Show yourself, Titus, in all respects. And Titus is a young leader that Paul's investing in here. He's guiding him. He says, Titus, show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. Right? Isn't that what we're talking about? Even in the things that a church needs to do is to be good. The good works are a clear port and an expression of the reality of the presence and the grace of God, that we would have good works. We'd be doing things that make a difference in our city. Wow. Be good works. And in your teaching, show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us. I think that's right. So here's the chart I told you I was going to show you. So if you take your world into 20-year segments, the last segment's a little longer than 20. It just, who knows how long that goes. But that is really saying that there are critical events that happen in the midst of these 20-year segments. And I think they're really, I'm becoming more convinced these are more powerful and more important than ever before. And that the first one is this, when 1 to 20, the key event in a person's life is finding their identity. Who they are. Yes, they need to go to school. Yes, they need to go to practice. Yes, they need to do this. Yes, they need to do that. They need to find out who in the world they are, their identity on the inside, not just individually, but kind of holistically. This is who I am. And we live in a nation, in a time where identity is so confused and they're not sure who they are or what they are. And it's tragic. Because it hurts people. And they need to find out who they are. You. And sometimes I try to say to people, to a young gal, hey, beautiful. Because it starts to say, this is who you are. You're beautiful. You're not ugly. You're not worthless. You're not this. You're not that. You're not too much this. You're beautiful. Hey, whatever. To encourage them as to who they are. Young gals need to hear from their fathers, I adore you. Young men need to hear, you have what it takes. You have strength. They're both the same word, right? It just reaches the different heart of a young person. Well, the next thing you need to learn from 20 to 40 is you need to learn and grow. It's all about learning and growing. Knowing who you are, then learn and grow. Do all the things. That's part of getting married sometimes, is you learn and grow, right? Whoa, wow, what a place to learn and grow. You know, that'll knock you off your socks, you know. But you try a job, and you get into the workforce, and you try some different things, and you learn and grow, and you make mistakes, and you learn and you grow. It's all about learning and growing. And then, in your 40 to 60s, you begin to wield influence. But if you didn't learn and grow, you don't have any influence to give. Funny thing is, our culture is that we move that influence into the 20 to 40 and say, influence us, but there's been no learning or no growing. And they don't have anything really to offer by way of influence. Now, these are broad categories, obviously, but I think there's some truth to these. And then when you're 60 to up, you offer wisdom. Because you learned who you were. You learned and you grew through all sorts of good and bad. You begin to have influence and you understand the power of influence, and sometimes it's negative power. And hopefully we come to a place of wisdom. And then here's the magical thing. Let's just circle that last one. Is that you want to take your wisdom and give it to those who are influencing and say, hey, be careful with the influence you wield. Do it this way. Some wisdom. We also give our wisdom to those who are learning and growing, because we learn. Sometimes, like I said, the good way and sometimes the hard way. And we have, hey, don't do it this way. Because I did it that way, and it wasn't very smart. Didn't get me anywhere. Or maybe something that did go well. And then we also give it back to the identity, those who are growing in their identity, right? It's these grandparents down here who are loving these kids in a really powerful way. How many people, I'll just say, how many people in here, your grandparents were a huge influence in your life? Yeah, you guys, it's not just parents, it's not just people around, these grandparents. And the incredible love that they have to offer these people. I usually find that grandparents are far more gracious with kids than parents are, you know, because we feel the importance, like, oh, okay, I'm going to discipline you, and I'm going to discipline you now. And in a grandparent, there's a little bit more graciousness sometimes. And so we have, that older group has a lot to give. And we have what? What have we done? We've taken the older generation, and we've asked them to go away. Please go away, and please be quiet. And if you're seen, you don't want to be heard. And it's crazy. It's crazy. Now, let's circle the 40 to 60-year-old. Having received the wisdom from the group before, let's go back a few, if we can. And I might go back another one. Yeah, they're right there. If we receive the wisdom from those above us, and then just think the incredible influence we have on those who are learning and growing, and the incredible influence on those who are developing their identity. This is a time of great power in life, and we ought to use it, really utilize it well. Then there's a 20 to 40-year-old, and if they're receiving, let's go one more this way, that way, whichever way. Let's circle the 20 to 40-year-old. If they receive the wisdom of that older generation, receive the influence of that generation right above them, and they really learn and grow, and it's powerful. It's a great time in life. And you know what? That group on helping those others just below them find identity is really important, right? You know, it's us parents, we go, wow, we love it when some of those younger people come into the lives of our children and go, help them, you know, because it's a really cool. And so what the things that Jake and that whole group is doing, he has some people in their 20s to 40s working with the kids. He has some people in their 40s to 60s working with their kids too. And they come and they help these young people beside us as parents to grow and learn. It's really important that we do this. So all these generations, now let's talk about that last generation. So far they've been the object of everything. Okay, so now this last generation, if you receive the wisdom of those who are older, the influence of those who are a little bit above you, the incredible influence of those who are just above you, and here's the beautiful thing, is that that generation has a lot to give us. You know what? They bring a lot of energy to the table. They bring a lot of fun to the table. They energize older people, and so, you know, for that next group up, it gives them a place to kind of be in the mix with them. And for the next older, for us to, there's just a lot of energy that comes with young people. It's fabulous. It's fun. It's interactive. And then even for those in the wisdom category. Well, I want to go back and look at this. To be a dynamic and integrated partnership of generations. I want us to consider whether really to do that, whether it be in a formal, structured way or an informal, unstructured way. Could we do that? Here's some realities, I think. First of all, it goes totally against the current of our culture. It totally goes against it. Even in families, it goes against the culture sometimes. So it's an uphill battle, right? It is. Secondly, it's awkward at best, and it is difficult at worst. It is awkward. I was talking to some of you the other day, and we did a meet and greet here, and they were left to talk to a really young set of group people, and it was awkward. They didn't have much to talk about. It's like, hi, you know? And it's just, sometimes it's hard. So we acknowledge that. That's probably why we shy away from it sometimes. It's kind of awkward. Next, it will increase the satisfaction of the millennial, the 20s and 30s. It'll increase their satisfaction in a church by 200%. That's what statistics show us, what surveys show. Millennials that will stay in a church, there was an intergenerational connect, will more than likely stay, and they'll enjoy it far more. Even if it's awkward, even if it's difficult, even if it's against the culture, it's better for them. Next. It'll be profoundly enjoyable, life-giving venue for those who are in the influencer or the wisdomers section. So, you know, young people are so valuable. It's so important for us to connect with. You hate to get isolated older in life. It's not fun. And there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of energy. It's good for us. We need it. And last is this. And almost most importantly, I don't know if it's most important, but I feel that for children and students, they'll come to know their value. When they are valued by older people, there's something rich for young people. They'll come to know who they are better by their connection with older people. I think it's profoundly important. So, here's the deal. We need to belong. So I want to give you a warning. The band can come on up. We're going to do a closing song. But we've tried to reserve a little bit of time between this and the Palooza for a meet and greet. And guess what I'm going to ask you to do? I'm going to ask you to mix it up generationally the best you can. Now, there's not a million young people. They're all in the back row. Not all of them, but many of them in the back row. But find someone you don't know. Find someone of maybe a little bit different generation and engage. We'll do it very informally. But when you're known and you know people in a church, cross-generationally, statistics tell us that it'll be 200% more enjoyable. Wow! If that's true and we don't do it, then we're foolish, we're crazy, we're out of our minds if we don't do it, right? And so we want this to be a place where there's an intergenerational. Now, I know I'm working against the culture here. I'm pushing back against the culture. And I don't know how successful we'll be as a church. But I'll bet if there is a friendly connectedness. Now, as you prepare for the meet and greet, you might want to think about what you're going to say. You might want to think about what you're going to ask. And you might go, I have no idea what to ask. I don't know if I know either, but all I know is if you engage and say hello and find out their hobby or what they're interested in or how they're doing in school or how they're not doing in school, how's the work going, what's it like to be a grandparent, just something, right? So you might want to think through what you're going to say to this people you're going to meet, okay? But in order to get there, we want to really worship together this God who made us. He brought us in young, right, of course, took us through middle of life, and for some, he's brought us to this older part of life. And he is the one that we worship at every stage, and we do it together. So let's stand and worship together.